welcome to Ask an Atheist, broadcasting to you from Tacoma, Washington, where our toll-free number is 844-SKEPTIC. I'm Becky, and with me in the studio are Bridget and Luke. How are you guys today?
I'm great.
Doing great.
Yeah, I'm not so great. I'm having that little bit of that gruff, sexy voice going on because, during the week, my day job, I am a school teacher, and man, the school petri dish, we have so many cultures in our school that it seems to have grown out into massive head colds.
I do not miss that part of teaching. That first week back at school, oh, it's the worst.
I'm trying a thing where I really enjoy making a connection with my students, and so, I am standing at my door, front door of my classroom, and I'm shaking hands with all of them as they come in, and I'm greeting them in Spanish and having them get the routine of how to greet someone in Spanish and ask how you're doing. And man, after about five of those over, 10 days, I think I caught one of the 180 little bugs. And now we're just fist bumping and waving at the door.
Yeah.
That's a good move. My kid gave me the norovirus last year, first week of school.
Oh, that's a fun one.
No.
Not at all.
Not even.
It's kind of a funny thing how, even with all of this evidence that's right in front of us of literally you shake 180 people's hands, and maybe if you don't wash your hands or you touch your eyes or, rub your nose or something, you might get sick from one of the 180 hands that you've touched. You know, that's a germ theory, right?
Right.
Just a theory.
Just a theory.
It really, hits home when we have folks that really doubt the scientific method and the robustness of the models that we've developed using science and empirical evidence and research. When someone says, I don't need a flu shot because, God will protect me. Or, man, the theory of evolution, that's just a theory. I was like, yeah, what else is theory? Germ theory.
Gravity.
Gravity.
Yeah. But speaking of school, I'd like to go down to Texas, where school's been in session for a long while, at least since August, where Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has come out in support of the school district that expelled a black student who refused to stand and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. India Landry was expelled last fall from Winfern High School near Houston when she engaged in a silent protest because she felt liberty and justice for all isn't what is going on in the country. A school official told Landry that school wasn't the NFL and insisted she be punished. Landry and her mother are suing the district on the grounds that her expulsion was racially motivated and unconstitutional. A.G. Paxton argued that school children cannot unilaterally refuse to participate in the pledge and that the pledge's mandatory nature has the laudable result of fostering respect for our flag and a patriotic love for our country. Texas school children currently may opt out of the pledge only with signed parental permission. Bridget, I think that you have some feelings on this, don't you?
I have a lot of feelings on this. So that statement that, students cannot unilaterally refuse to participate in the pledge, actually the First Amendment says we can. You cannot force a pledge. You cannot force a vow on a regular basis. I mean, regardless of whether you're a child or an adult, it cannot be forced.
And now school children actually do have limited rights in some respects. I mean, we can as school officials tell them, how to dress or how not to dress in some respects, what kind of words to say, whether they can bring certain weapons or objects on campus. But this doesn't fall under
this
one of those limited
one of those things.
Rights. Okay?
Exactly. This is a right across the board. And I was a teacher for a few years, and well, I worked with students I worked with deaf and hard of hearing students. And so I would interpret the pledge, but if I wasn't interpreting for that moment, I would always silently, respectfully sit during the pledge. And some of my younger students had a really hard time wrapping their head around it because they had been taught their entire life that they had to do this. So having this conversation with my second and third graders one day, apparently got me in trouble, and I had to express my reasoning behind why I did it and why I had this conversation with the students. And fortunately that was the one time my boss actually agreed with me. And she was like, yeah, no, this is actually a constitutional thing. They don't have to. And so I won that one, but
now, Luke, you've got a young child.
I do.
Do you know whether he decides to say the pledge or not? Because in Washington State, it is a law since somewhere post 9/11 that the pledge be recited and flag exercises be done at every public school every morning.
We haven't had that conversation yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, I really should, now that I think about it. It just totally slipped my mind. No, it's not not something we've talked about, and I'm sure his school does do it. So I'm going to need to have that discussion with him.
Yeah. You know, it's really, you know, interesting when you look at the pledge from both an atheist and humanist perspective and from the perspective of a student who is choosing to not participate because of, you know, not believing that we have liberty and justice for all. This is what Ms. Landry had said. Mm-hmm. You know, she said, I don't think that this is what's going on in our country. We don't have liberty and justice, so I'm not going to say something that I don't believe. And for a school official to say this isn't the NFL, right?
That's obviously racially motivated.
Horribly racially motivated.
And so whether it's something that's racially motivated or saying, you know, stand up for God and country, you know, attacking the beliefs of a humanist child or an atheist child, I think what this does is really come to bear that we shouldn't have this enforced and coerced upon our students.
Could you imagine if there were any other vows that you had made in your life that were then forced to recite them daily? Like, if somebody came to me and said, you need to recite your marriage vows every day, I'd be like, no, that's abusive.
I mean,
that's not...
if you chose to, own accord.
Totally fine.
That's cool.
But being forced to make a vow is not making a vow. It's abusive. This is an abusive relationship at this point. I'd be like, honey, you got to get out of that. That's not okay. Like,
I kind of hate to go here with that, but it's kind of an indoctrination.
Yeah.
I'm kind of, it's not really.
It's not patriotic. It's nationalism.
It is that.
So in this case, when you have the state attorney general that's saying, you know, they can't unilaterally refuse to participate in the pledge, you wonder, aren't you the person who's supposed to be, you know, enforcing laws? Aren't you the person who's supposed to be, you know, being there for your constituents and your citizens in suing, you know, for their constitutional rights? And to have the attorney general say, no, I side with the school in this case, that should put a lot of folks in Texas, you know, on edge for whether you can express yourself based on, you know, based on your religious convictions, or whether you want to protest something because you believe that something is racially inequitable. I think that this sends a horrible message to both school children and the general population in Texas. And I'm really happy that actually our state law, right, says that all these flag exercises have to be done, but for students wishing not to recite the pledge, they can be respectfully silent.
Yeah.
And that's actually what I have posted on my classroom wall underneath my flag.
Yeah.
Right. I have in very tiny little letters, right, the RCW, the Revised Code of Washington, that says what the pledge is. And underneath it, I have in bold letters the part where it says students wishing to do it well shall recite this pledge, and students not wishing to will be, you know, will remain respectfully silent. And then underneath it, I've got all the different forms that our Pledge of Allegiance has taken over the years.
Yeah.
Like the one that doesn't say under God?
Like that one. Like precisely that one. And most of my students seem to think that that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I think we probably talked about this last year, maybe at the beginning of the school year as well, because, you know, it's the kind of thing like, oh, this is a different classroom. What do we got to do here? And in my classroom, no, you don't have to stand up, because in no classrooms in the state of Washington are you forced to stand up as a student and recite that pledge. You're not even forced to stand. You can't be forced to stand.
No.
I'm gonna get on you if you're seated and you're sitting there talking with your friends and, you know, making your phone buzz. but other than that, I mean, that's just because you're not being respectfully silent.
Right.
The fact that you're not standing up, I don't got a problem with that.
Nope.
Well, I hope Ms. Landry is able to really established that this is, you know, that her silent protest is constitutionally protected and that no future student in Texas would face expulsion for refusal to recite the pledge. Let's stay in Texas for a moment here.
Texas.
Yeah. The Fort Bend County, Texas, local Republican Party posted a full page ad in the local Indian American community newspaper encouraging Hindus to vote GOP because Ganesh, one of Hinduism's most important gods, takes the form of an elephant. Under the auspices of wishing the Greater Houston Hindu community a happy Ganesh Chaturthi, below a large infographic that explained the symbology embodied by Ganesh, the ad featured the question, "Would you worship a donkey or an elephant? The choice is yours," between two graphics promoting the local Republican Party.
What? I mean, okay, maybe people in the GOP would fall for that, but like... They're not even.
So here's behind the scenes what I'm imagining going on. Hey, did you know that Indian people like worshiping an elephant? Hey, did you know that our symbol for our political party is an elephant? Maybe we can trick them into worshiping our political party. What do you guys think? Huh?
Great idea. No, that kind of brings to mind, aren't there a lot of mentions of donkeys in the Bible?
Yeah, even talking donkeys.
Even, shouldn't Christians vote for Democrats then, because that's their symbol?
There's about as much ground, about as much rational ground for that.
The idea that they want us to worship their political party, that's terrifying.
It actually gets at a really good point there.
It's not surprising.
The injection of the word worship, would you worship a donkey or an elephant?
Uh-huh.
You know, and here's the thing, you're not worshiping an elephant.
No.
As a Hindu American, you have a particular religious belief that takes the embodied form of an elephant. It's part of your tradition. But to say that, oh, yes, we are the elephants that you should worship. I mean, you're trying to draw people away from their own religious convictions and traditions in order to score some political points. I'm really hoping that this is backfiring on the county's GOP.
Yeah, I hope so too, because there's so many things wrong with this whole concept. Like, it's icky.
But here's the thing. The Indian American Community newspaper actually accepted the advertisement. So are they that short of funds for full page advertising? Are there Republican voting, you know, community newspaper board members?
I'm sure there are.
So is the last laugh? Are they having the last laugh of saying, they think that, you know, we'll vote with their party just because Ganesh takes the form of an elephant, but we're going to take their money for our newspaper? Ha ha ha.
I mean,
might as well.
You might as well. And also, it's kind of a nice way to bring it to the attention of the community, of the local community, be like, okay, they paid us to run this, and I'm sure they're getting letters to the editor, right? I mean, they've got to be getting some commentary back on this. And so, like, making them aware that, yeah, the local GOPs, they're trying to convince you that this is part of your religious belief.
There's also this weird aspect of, I'll say, republisplaining going on here, because it's literally a diagram, this infographic of Ganesh, and it's pointing out all of the symbology, and it's like big eyes to, you know, capture and see all, and, you know, multi-handed. It's like the Republican Party is educating the Hindu community what their own religious symbols mean. There's something a little awry here.
My guess is they just copy and pasted an infographic from
like a sixth grade textbook or something.
and then put the Republican stuff over the top.
Yep.
Just so they could look like they fit in.
So there's no citations or anything even. So not only have you insulted the Hindu community of Greater Texas, but you've also plagiarized. Good job, Fort Bend County, Texas GOP. Should we go to India, where there's actually some really amazing, awesome news?
Yes, please.
Yes, let's go to actual India. Where we don't have a GOP, where we have a Supreme Court of India that issued two rulings this month that eliminate adultery and homosexuality as criminal acts. Under the colonial era adultery law known as Section 497, a man who had sex with a married woman faced up to 5 years jail time if he failed to get her husband's consent. Justices,
what?
Yes, you have a question here?
So, nothing about the woman's consent.
Yeah. So here's the thing. If a man had sex with a married woman who he wasn't married to, you know, a woman who was married to someone else, to a different man, and they engaged in relations, that dude, the cheater, faced up to 5 years jail time if he failed to get the husband's consent.
Oh.
So that was a thing that existed in India. Justices deemed that statute to be archaic, arbitrary, and unconstitutional, saying that husband is not the master of wife, women should be treated with equality along with men. And then a law from the same era of British rule known as Section 377 had criminalized sex between gay people as an unnatural offense punishable by 10 years imprisonment. And the unanimous decision to overturn that law stated that criminalizing carnal intercourse is irrational, arbitrary, and manifestly unconstitutional.
Yay!
Can we have their Supreme Court?
Yeah, seriously. I mean, first of all, there's only 5 people, so I kind of like the, you know, 9 justices. I'm not really keen on you know, one of the ones that we're thinking about putting into that little 9th vacant spot at the moment. But, you know, there's 5 justices. And here's the thing. They all agreed. They were in unanimous agreement on this of saying, no, we're not going to legislate what you do between consenting adults in your, you know, in the privacy of your own relationships. And that's wonderful.
It's fantastic.
Another really cool thing that I like about this one is that they literally said this old law, the adultery one, treated women as chattel and women are not chattel. So it was a good one. I mean, and I think this isn't just looking at colonial rule and that British Anglican sort of sensibility, but these were laws that were also upheld and supported by many of the more conservative religious sects in India, not the least of which was Hinduism. I mean, Luke, before show, you were looking up Hinduism is clearly the overwhelmingly
the largest population of all religious people are Hindu.
Somewhere around 78%,
right around
like that.
79.
But then there's a bunch of other, you know, religious minorities that exist within the Indian state.
14% Muslim and 6% other, with the largest of the other making up or being made up by Christians.
Okay, so there's obviously a history of Catholicism in the Indian subcontinent because, you know, Mother Teresa and everything. You've got Jainists, which is a uniquely Indian tradition, right?
Yes.
And these kinds of statutes weren't just colonial from England, but were also religiously upheld. And you could say, well, Christianity was a colonial religion, sure. But you have Hinduism and Islam that are also in support of these laws in the more conservative practice of these of these traditions. And I think that this is a really good step for India to say, you know, no, we are a pluralistic society where even if you have these religious traditions, they're not going to be part of our criminal code.
So I have one question. Are they accepting refugees?
That is a tough thing. We know that in a lot of places, and I imagine that you're kind of tongue-in-cheek looking from America, but in a lot of places around the world, you still have women that are treated as chattel. And you still have women who don't have any say in, you know, who they decide to have any kind of, you know, relations with, whether it's being married off, whether it's deciding to, you know, have a relationship outside of the one that you have with your husband. And the fact that you would have, you know, sex between gay people that is still criminal in many countries, that is a legitimate refugee seeking or asylum seeking, cause for many people. So I'm good on India for that. And I don't know if you guys had seen some of the celebratory kind of announcements.
I have. So beautiful. It's just like, they get me a little teary eyed because it's been such a long time for them to have to struggle through this. And I'm really glad that they're able to be open and honest about who they are now.
Of course, I didn't realize this was even an issue until I saw it in the news. And then I was like, but this is the second largest country in the world and this is still going on?
Yeah, the most populous thing where you weren't allowed to have, you know, gay folks be able to be gay. There was one thing that really struck me was when you have the photos of the celebrations, you know, after this announcement, after this ruling came out, they are the same faces of joy that we see when Obergefell ruling came out in the United States, or when individual states had those rulings that decriminalized homosexuality, or in any number of nations, it's the same faces of joy. And while the colors and features of those faces will differ, that same joy is one of those humanity affirming things, right? That we have all of these shared feelings and shared joy and shared grief when we're restricted from being our truest selves. And I think that was one of the things that really struck me.
It's one of those that makes me super happy things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. This is Ask an Atheist. You can tweet us at Ask an Atheist WA or find us at atheist.radio. We'll be back after the break.
This episode was sponsored by Cephalopod.
Hey, my little fishies. It's Jusubu89. Today I'm here with Donut Reviews, a work I'm going to be reviewing squid ink patches. They're said to cure common colds.
I hear they can even cure squiditis.
No way.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do this. So we grab the patches. Oh, well, they're kind of slimy.
Yeah, that's kind of weird, but cool at the same time.
And then you stick them on right about here.
Right here?
Yeah.
Okay, on the count of three.
One, two, three. Do not use squid ink products. Despite their seemingly magical benefits, those claims are flimsy. They conduct their business in a shady manner, and we believe that Cephalopod is dealing on the black market. You may even turn into a tentacle monster. Beware.
And welcome back to Ask an Atheist. Bridget, in the break, you had brought up something, actually, where you had experienced or overheard right here in good old United States, in good old Washington,
yeah.
Something that kind of reminded you of that women as chattel and some of the kind of more disturbing things, some of those religious justifications for subjugation of women.
Yeah, here we are in very liberal Seattle, and I was on the bus in downtown Seattle, and there was a person next to me wearing a sweatshirt that said church, love God, love family, love life, or something like that. And he was on the phone. And
so you took him to be a religious individual.
A religious individual based on his clothing. There was also a cross on a chain over the sweatshirt. And there was he was on the phone talking to, I presume, another man. And the only part of the conversation, because I was only on this bus for a very short period of time, and I heard this conversation, and it's a very crowded bus, and on the phone he says to this other person, I don't care if you beat her, just, you know, as long, I mean, you're not going to beat her hard, right? I mean, don't leave any marks, but also, you know, you have to make sure that you hit her hard enough that she's not going to tell anyone.
So what kind of reaction was there from anyone on the bus? That sounds horrifying.
I was horrified. I was looking around at other people, and there was literally zero response from anybody else on the bus. And it was like, I was looking for backup, and, you know, a lot of people had their headphones in and probably didn't hear it. And those who didn't weren't even acknowledging it. They weren't acknowledging that there was anything unusual or worrisome about it. They at least they weren't reacting in a way that made me think that.
That's just crazy.
Yeah.
I gotta admit, if I were in that moment, I would have a really hard time coming up to a gentleman who I had no prior relationship with, who now is advising on how to abuse, an intimate partner, whose victim would presumably be a woman, to say, hey, man, that's really messed up. Like, I don't know that I could bring myself to do that.
Social pressure in this instance is to keep your head down, don't talk to people on the bus.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's so much social pressure as it would be fear from this gentleman.
Right.
I was afraid. I carry pepper spray with me, and I had it prepped and ready to go in case, like, he noticed that I was observing him or had overheard or anything, because I was terrified. And I posted it on Facebook right after it happened because I had to tell somebody, you know, and my hands were shaking and I was sitting on this bench And I was very grateful that Hugh did not get off the bus at my stop. Like, I was watching for him because I don't know how he's going to react if he knows that I've witnessed this, you know?
That's awful.
Yeah. So my question here is, if someone is wearing messaging that someone would assume would mean that you're a member of a church, that you have a love of your family and God and things like that, does that afford someone who's wearing those kinds of things a little bit of protection from scrutiny, from social scrutiny, from outside scrutiny?
Well, I remember when I was raised religious, and when I was in the church, people would do things that I would kind of raise an eyebrow at, or, you know, question them about it, and they'd say, oh, it's okay because I'm forgiven. And I was like, but you're still doing things that are objectively harming others. It could be something as simple as swindling them out of money for something, like they were selling a car that wasn't running. And I was like, but you said that it was running. You took their money and knowing that the car is going to break down in just a couple of miles. And they're like, it's okay. I've been forgiven.
Right. So they can do whatever they want because they're Christian and Jesus forgives them and they can get away with anything.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
But now, I know that there's not every religious sect, and certainly not even all Christian sects that ascribe to that.
Right.
But my question is really whether when you see someone that, you know, is wearing their love, faith, life, etc., you know, accoutrements, what that says to me is, are you someone who's wearing that because you live it and believe it? Are you someone who's wearing that believing that it indemnifies you against bad behavior, or are you someone who's wearing that knowing that you will be perceived as good, as just, and as trustworthy despite all of your, you know, horrible behaviors towards people?
Should we create a ironic not all Christians tag?
Well, I mean, I don't think that that's the job of us, right? I mean, none of us sitting in this room are Christians. But here's the thing: when I have that kind of, you know, thought, I know that it's not all Christians, but I don't know which Christians it
is.
Right.
There's no way to know.
I don't know, except for observing you and knowing you as a person.
That's the only way.
And just as how some folks get to know me as someone who's non-religious. And say, hey, you know what, I know you as a person, and I know that just because you don't believe in God, you do the morally just right things and you work well, you know, to improve the human condition. I can do that with plenty of religious individuals.
Right. That takes me back to the you're so nice. How could you be an atheist statement I heard a while back?
Oh, you've gotten that one. Oh, yeah. Bridget, you've got that too, haven't you?
I've gotten that too.
So at the risk of, you know, me not coming up to, you know, a colleague and being like, oh, I didn't realize that you were an evangelical Christian, but you're so nice and easy to work with. You know, I do want to say, like, I am more cautious of individuals who outwardly display their religiosity because I've had experiences with individuals that have used that as a way to indemnify themselves against consequences or against perceived consequences for doing wrong.
The same. I don't trust businesses that flaunt the Jesus fish on their advertisement because I don't know if they're going to try to screw me over.
Yeah, I actively avoid any sort of business or interactions with strangers on the street if they're wearing religious paraphernalia, just because I'm like, been there, done that. I don't need to interact with those people. And like, when I was a religious person, I felt it was a very personal thing. So I wore a very simple little gold cross that was given to me at my baptism when I was a child. But I tried very hard to not like overtly show anything like that, just because it was my personal choice. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'll go a little bit of a different angle, and I'll say that I do business with individuals and businesses that are religiously founded and motivated. But the reason I do it is because, they've never this is our mailbox, folks, right? The people that we have our PO box for Ask an Atheist. And they've never batted an eye at the fact that, you know, mail comes to atheists. They've always treated us well, given us a little bit of grace if we missed a, you know, month, or we paid outright for 6 months and we didn't realize that our 6 month renewal had come up. Okay, all right, we got you, you know, and giving us a little grace that way. And that through their businesses, a portion of their businesses go towards a charity that they believe is good and helping and is motivated by their particular, you know, religious inclinations. And it helps, you know, build homes and do home restoration for senior homebound individuals. And I'm like, you know what? I have no problem with that whatsoever.
That's yeah. awesome.
But do they have like religious imagery in their advertising or on their signage or anything like that?
As far as I can tell, no fishes and things like that. Just says a portion of our proceeds go to these particular things. And every December they've got boxes of, you know, Christmas themed shortbread cookies that they feel a little bit awkward saying, I'm really sorry, we don't have a different one, but do you want cookies? I was like, it's cookies.
Shortbread.
I don't care whether it's a gingerbread man and a Christmas tree. That's all right. Yeah. I like it. And they're like, okay, well, it's gluten-free. Yeah, I don't believe in that box either. So.
I'll still eat it.
Yeah. So here's my other question, though. Would you look more favorably upon a business that was advertising itself with a red A or a happy humanist symbol?
I'd have to actually do business with them and see how they treated me.
Yeah.
I'm that way with the Christian ones eventually, too.
Yeah. Like, if they were advertising with something like that, I would probably go and, like, work with them at least at first. And if they didn't, you know, act in a way that I felt was worthy of being part of my group, I guess, in a way that, I mean, not being a part of my group, but if they were acting in a way that I felt didn't really show what a humanist or a person who identified in that way so publicly wasn't being respectful of that, then maybe I probably wouldn't go back, but I'd give them a shot.
Yeah. Interesting things to think about. I don't think that there's anything within any of the, aspirations of humanism. And that's what it's called. They're not called tenets. They're not called doctrines. It's called humanism and its aspirations. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything in the aspirations of humanism that says once forgiven, always forgiven, so I can do whatever the heck I want.
Right.
No.
And that's something that actually comforts me.
Very much.
So on to something that maybe is a little bit similar, a little bit different, where you have a religious person that recognizes when harm is being done and tries to change a system from within. And this brings us to a Mormon bishop who has been excommunicated from his faith for his opposition to sexually explicit questioning of teen church members by elders. Sam Young, who's a 65-year-old grandfather, had campaigned to change so-called worthiness interviews, which he characterized as physically, emotionally, and spiritually abusive. All Mormon youth are subjected to inquiries by a bishop on adherence to the church's sexual code of conduct, which at times would include probing of explicit details regarding children and teens' sexual experiences and desires. Some questions are even asked of child molestation and rape victims under the auspices of chastity interviews. Young's edict states that his opinion or position on protecting children was not the factor in his excommunication, but rather his persistent, aggressive effort to persuade others to his point of view and his public opposition to church leaders.
Good job, Sam Young. You go.
If a church leader is advocating that you do this to children, I think that they deserve some opposition.
Right. Yeah. I'm saddened that this man was kicked out of the church. That's his foundation of community, and now he doesn't have that.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, a lot of... it's so hard to change things from within. Like, you think that that's how you do it, but... It's a very difficult concept, and so I'm not surprised that he was excommunicated. Like, when you have these, like, really ingrained foundational concepts in your organization, getting them to change, I mean, it's not going to take one voice. It's going to take many, many voices to get that changed.
So a few things on that. Speaking of the many voices, he's had petitions that have said, these are the things that have been asked of young people. We want this eliminated. And the change from within the church, one of the things that he did was to do a hunger strike. You know, he said, look, I'm going to exist only on electrolytes for a month, a little honey and salt in warm water, until anyone of church leadership decides to say that any number of these specific questions, just eliminate one of them, just make one of these questions off limits. And I don't really want to get into the details of the specific questions, the specificity with which these bishops, these elders, these men in a room solo with a young teen who could be a girl or a boy or, you know, or any youth was asking about, because some of the detail, the level of detail in these questions was traumatic to read.
I read about the first five questions and I couldn't get past them because I was just like, this is disgusting. Why would anybody care about anybody else's, whether adult or child, but especially to ask those questions of a child? That's just abhorrent.
So he went on a hunger strike to say, hey, church elders, just eliminate one of these things. Make one of these things off limits. No, no. Okay. All right. Fine.
So they bring these questions up when they ask people about instances of abuse, too, don't they?
So it has come to light that, yes, you might have a child that has been a target of abuse or molestation or rape. And in a church context where any kind of activity regarding genitalia might be considered a violation of chastity, those questions apparently apply. And for those of us that are, you know, understanding the difference between, you know, the regular sexual expression that, a 16-year-old kid might have and the desires that they might have, or, you know, did you make out with your boyfriend kind of questions, there's a difference between that and asking an 11-year-old before their baptism, you know, whether they had any responsibility and responsiveness to their abuse.
So they're making abuse victims potentially relive that whole episode there.
Yes.
In the church.
And not in a therapeutic way.
No.
In an accusatory way.
Right.
So one of the other cool things that that I want to give this guy props for, in terms of changing things from within, he said, you know what, I participated in this. This was wrong of me to have done. And now, knowing that my children and my granddaughters have been exposed to this, this is something that should be turned around, that should be changed. And, you know, it's not like the church is fixed. It's not like any church is fixed in its views, right? You have the Mormon church saying we're going to allow women to wear pants inside the temple. I mean, and that was revolutionary. So it's not like things can't change. And they said, hey, you know what, Mr. Young, we did change our worthiness interview procedure. A child can go into their little, you know, office with their bishop, with their elder, and they're allowed to have another adult present. They're allowed to have a parent present.
Oh,
great.
Because that makes things so much better.
I mean, I don't know about you, but when I was 16 years old and making out with boyfriends, it wouldn't have made me more comfortable or feel less invaded upon to have my mom or dad sitting with me as someone asked me about exactly where someone's tongue was when I was making out with him.
That would be even more terrifying.
And yeah. It would be more terrifying. And hey, my mom was a sexual health educator, and we were pretty open about a lot of those things. I still wouldn't have wanted her there for an interview.
My parents were not.
Yeah. No.
No.
And I mean, honestly, with a lot of these parents, they're not going to be advocating for their child to not answer those questions. And that would be my imagined role of having another adult present, is to be like, that's not an acceptable question.
Well, because
these parents are used to it. That's what they were asked. And
also the parents are risking going against an elder in their church. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And especially with an unequal treatment of men versus women within the LDS community, you wouldn't want to have, you know, a mother facing the decision of whether to advocate for her child in front of a male elder who can make life more difficult for her, give her different assignments for family visitation that she doesn't mm-hmm. want, take away her Sunday school teaching assignments. Like, it can, you know, you're weighing all of those things.
I have several people over in Kitsap that have dropped out of the Mormon community because of reasons like this, and they've joined our group, the Kitsap Atheists and Agnostics. And for many of them, we replaced their community, a community they built their lives around. And risking that community and without having some sort of backup is just terrifying for many people.
I think that brings to the fore one of the really important things that humanists and atheists can do. And even if you don't want to specifically rally around atheism or humanism or your non-belief, but form a community that is non-sectarian in nature, and you're going to be bound to have folks that are essentially refugees from being kicked out of their churches or deciding to leave their churches or religious traditions when things became too difficult, or when you were kicked out of your own home, you know, as a child who didn't want to do the worthiness interviews. You know, you didn't have those parents. When, you know, you have any number of communities that are there as sort of landing pads, they don't have to be centered around humanism or atheism. You want to have philosophy club. You want to have a outdoors hiking club. You know, and I think that shows the importance, or it brings up the importance of having those places.
It's what we as humans do. We need those groups to be together.
We are social animals, and the idea that you have to have like some belief in a higher power to belong to a community it's wrong. I mean, and that's what I really appreciate about the crew here at Ask an Atheist and the meetups that we have, is that anybody can come, and suddenly if they're looking for a community, they have one, you know. And it's really beautiful that I can invite somebody that I meet at, say, the zoo, and they come to a one of our meetups, and they are so grateful to have that community immediately, where they aren't being forced to ask sexually explicit questions of minors or believe in a deity or a higher power or anything like that, where they can just come and be themselves.
Now, I got a question for you guys. Have you ever joined what you thought was something like a outdoor hiking group, or maybe a gaming club or something like that, and found out that you're the only non-religious person there?
I got to think that one over.
I have not, that I'm aware of. I have been in work situations where I've found that I'm the only non-religious person there, and that was awkward. But no, I vet my groups pretty thoroughly beforehand, and I want to make sure that I'm not going to come into contact with people who think that I should be stoned to death just for my lack of belief.
I've been really careful about it too for the past, you know, 5 or 6 years. I mean, at work, it is definitely an issue because of just where I work. Like on Friday, a guy was saying, hey, you know why everybody's having so much trouble with stress now? It's because we just don't pray as much as a country.
Oh, really? It's not because we're feeling that our laws and autonomy is being threatened by, you know, public policy or anything like that?
No,
it's
a lack of praying.
Okay. All right. Got it. Thanks, man. That was real helpful of you.
That's
I feel so unstressed suddenly.
Feel right.
Yes. Let me just pray to your invisible friend and it'll all be great.
Now, I mean, that can be a valid stress relieving
thing
for some people, but you know what? It's not something to be forced upon everyone else.
It's very similar to meditation in that aspect, but no, you don't need to force that on other people.
No.
So, I don't know. I think that there's lots of different ways to form community and have stress relief. We'll see after the break if we have any more stressful things or stressless things.
Beware squid ink. The Sikasum magnets don't work. You don't run any faster. Warning, they shock you. True fact. Also, they are way too expensive, and all they want is your gold. They are taking over the world, one bracelet at a time.
Mamma mia, here we go again.
Hi, I'm Professor Poopy Pants.
Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. It's me, Becky, and Bridget, and Luke in the studio today. And we've got a question, some feedback from Stacy from Tacoma that asks, do you happen to know how atheists get sworn into court? The SCOTUS nomination has me wondering. Both Ford and Kavanaugh were sworn in with the so help me God part. So we did a little bit of background research and digging into the depths of our own personal experience in various Washington state counties. Have either of you been ever called to testify in court?
No.
Never been. Well, I've been called to testify, but then I didn't have to because they took a plea deal as we were driving to the courthouse to,
all
to
right.
testify.
Okay, so. Okay. But we, at least Bridget, you and I have been sworn in as jurors right? Yeah. And have you also, Luke?
I never had the opportunity.
Okay.
It didn't work out.
So at least in Pierce County, no Bibles that I had to put my hand on. No so help me gods. No God was there to help me. All I did was raise my right arm. And the judge said, you know, do you swear or affirm to, you know, fulfill all the duties and obligations of a juror? And we all said, yep. And that was it.
That was nice. That was how it was in Snohomish County, too. There was no in God. There was no so help me God. There was nothing like that. And I remember somebody on the jury saying under their breath, so help me God.
Okay.
It was really funny.
So God
like,
can help
okay,
that person.
Cool. You know, that's fine.
I did do that for court a couple of times, just for personal issues. But yeah, no, I've never had to say under God or.
So here's a real cool thing that Washington State does. When you have someone that you don't even need to swear on a Bible, someone can bring their own Bible if they wish to, or someone can say, yes, God is helping me not be, you know, deceptive, or God is helping me tell the truth. That's great.
Sure.
But it's not something that someone has to opt out of. Right.
Right.
It's something that a religious person can opt into.
Right. Yeah. And a lot of in the research that I was doing, a lot of counties, you do have to opt out of the religious thing, which is, I mean, it's terrible to have to out yourself in a situation like that. It's like, here you are, you're on a jury with like 11, 12 other people, and you have to work with them for the duration of the trial. So here you are, you're outing yourself right away to these people that you don't really know, and then you have to get them to believe in you or trust you.
Well, and that's when you're serving as a juror. What if you're
right.
a witness?
If you're a witness, it's going to be even worse.
I mean, what if there's a few people on the jury that believe with absolute certainty that if you're not Christian, you're not necessarily telling the truth?
Right.
That's going to be really problematic for someone to be a credible witness. And so I think that it would be amazing and awesome if we just universally within the United States had that kind of thing. I mean, we know that this came about because it was just common practice that we know that you're telling the truth because of your belief in God. When everyone is roughly from the same flavor of God belief, that can work, right? But we're a pluralistic society. We don't have that. That's what made one particular part of the Kavanaugh hearings so jolting and jarring for me, because you had this Senator Kennedy, not of the Kennedy sort of legacy, but this Republican from Louisiana, I believe, ask Kavanaugh, do you believe in God? Which seems like a weird thing because, you know, we know that there's no religious test for holding public office or for having been appointed to particular court cases and court appointments. But he still asked, do you believe in God? So I'm like, okay, where is he going with this? Kavanaugh says, I do. And then Kennedy says that he was going to give him a last opportunity because he was the final member of the Senate that was in this committee that was questioning Kavanaugh. He said, I'm going to give you a last opportunity right here, right in front of God and country. I want you to look me in the eye. Are Dr. Ford's allegations true? Right? So, you know, Kavanaugh is being asked as if all of his credibility rests on his belief in God and the fact that God and the rest of the country is right there in the room with him.
Doesn't that bring us back to our previous point where he can lie all he wants and he's Christian, so he's forgiven?
I don't know what flavor of God belief Kavanaugh is. Maybe he is part of the ones where you could say once forgiven, always forgiven, you know, once baptized, once you've accepted Jesus. But and maybe Senator Kennedy comes from that background as well, which is a really good point, Luke, because I don't want to, you know, rest any of my convictions with Kavanaugh's God belief on whether this woman is telling the truth or not. And what happens if Dr. Ford decides that she's going to swear or affirm to tell the truth, but not on a Bible and not with God helping her? Is Kennedy going to believe Ford or is Kennedy going to believe Kavanaugh?
Yeah,
he's going to believe Kavanaugh.
But she did swear to God.
Yeah,
that was part of her oath. And so I don't know if that was necessarily by choice or if it was sort of a step in the game, you know, to make her seem more credible. But I don't know.
Well, and I have no understanding of what Dr. Ford's religious convictions are, nor does it matter to me. It
doesn't matter.
Because I'm not going to believe her being more credible or less credible based on her belief in God.
If I remember correctly, at the federal level, you have to actually let them know beforehand that you don't necessarily want to do an under God kind of, or a so help you God kind of oath. Like for the oath of office, it's all so help you God at the end. Usually you're doing it in a group of like 30 people. So what do you do?
You just eliminate that, you know, little thing and be silent for that. Okay. That's, I think, one thing that probably many atheists might do or might choose to do, just like when we're asked to recite the pledge, we might be silent for the under God part or silent for the entirety of the Pledge of Allegiance. So it's, you know, it's a real issue. I'm glad that Washington State does not require that. But in a lot of places around the country, it's either county by county or it's, like you said, Luke, at the federal level, or it's just a given that you're going to swear on the Bible. I love when we see some atheists or non-religious individuals that are sworn into office and they do have to place their hand on something. And so there have been non-religious individuals that have placed their hand upon the U.S. Constitution.
Yes.
That's kind of a neat one.
That makes sense.
Gives me a little bit of pause, though, when I'm like, you're replacing religious doctrine of the Bible with the Constitution. Are you upholding the Constitution as some inflexible religious doctrine? You know, feeds into that, hey, that sort of religiosity of the founding fathers and all of our founding documents as our scripture.
Well, but here's the thing is that the Constitution isn't once written, never altered. There have been many, many amendments made to it. It is a basically, like, to use a linguistic phrase, like living language, it's a living document. It's constantly being changed and altered. And I think that it's a good, if you're going to have a document to swear an oath to, having a living document that can be changed and updated based on new evidence, probably the best way to go.
I like it. I like it. And I certainly like it a lot more than you believe in God. Good. Do you swear to him? Do you swear to God? Do you swear to God? Because Kennedy actually asked, like, so no doubt in your mind that these allegations against you are true. And he's like, correct. No doubt. Nothing. And they go back and forth with this zero, nada, 100% certain, no scintilla of doubt. You know, I mean, how many ways can you say zero doubt and 100% certainty? They went for it. And then at the very end, he closes with, do you swear to God? And Kavanaugh says, I swear to God. As if that's the final gavel. As if that's the bang at the end of your thing, saying, great, okay, I trust him now.
I would take a pinky swear over. Do you pinky swear? Do you pinky swear?
That kind of reminds me of a used car salesman with a little fish on his sign.
Okay. I want a pinky affirm.
Yeah, pinky affirm.
I want to swear. So, guys, there was a neat thing that caught my attention across my little social media feed. And I looked into the way that a few other places were reporting this. And here we go. Some of the little headlines that are all about this one same story. You guys ready for a little bit?
Sure.
Okay, so from Express UK, I read that brave Indonesian teenager survived 49 days adrift at sea by burning own boat. Oof. That was really cool.
Like that seems counterintuitive, but
so,
okay.
So there's this kid. He has a fishing hut that became unmoored, and it went adrift. And when his cooking gas ran out, he was able to catch fish, but then he didn't have anywhere to cook them, and so he took pieces of the hut, of the fishing hut, and burned those.
That makes more sense than what I was imagining.
Yes.
Not a giant bonfire of floating doom.
Exactly. So BBC says Indonesian teenager survives 49 days adrift at sea in fishing hut. Okay. All right. Pretty descriptive, right? Mm-hmm. Pretty miraculous and amazing. Like, that's a really awesome
49 days.
Feat of survival, right? Yeah. He only had 1 week's worth of rations for food and
fresh water is a huge issue in this situation.
Absolutely. CNN reported Indonesian teen rescued after 49 days drifting at sea. Awesome. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we got a rescue. He actually was able to signal using a walkie-talkie, like a little radio, send a distress signal to a passing ship. They picked him up. It was all the way by Guam, which is amazing.
Whoa. Wow.
Panamanian ship picked him up in Guamanian waters all the way from Indonesia. So this is, you know, about a month and a half that this kid is floating around.
Wow.
The Guardian has a little bit of a longer one. It says, Indonesian teenager's ocean ordeal. After a week, I started to get scared. Aldi novel Adi Lang, who spent 49 days adrift at sea, recalls his worst moments and his noisy reunion with his parents. Right? Any parent would be happy to get their kid back.
Yeah.
Right? And the Jakarta Post says, Indonesian teenager survives 49 days adrift in Guam waters. And then we get down to Fox News.
Good old Fox News.
Fox News say, guys, you ready for this? Indonesian teen survives 49 days adrift without paddle, but with Bible.
Did he use it as a paddle?
That's what I was thinking.
I really loved this one because it did seem like, oh, that's a great use for a Bible.
Sure.
Right.
It's got that nice gold around the outside of the pages and the leather. That's at least how I'm imagining it. And so it would be watertight for a little while. You know, it would hold up okay.
Yep.
At the very least, you could use the binding after a while.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I really want Indonesian teen survives 49 days adrift using ingenuity and the technology that was developed over 60 years ago to send signals through the airwaves using solar energy to charge your walkie-talkie. I mean, that's really what's going on here.
Right,
right.
Indonesian teen survives based on human ingenuity.
There you go.
He is an incredibly skilled sea person. But the Bible.
If Bible. You believe that a Bible has been able to save your toast in your times of adrift, please do give us a call at 844-SKEPTIC or tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA. Find us at atheist.radio. We are Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. Thank you, Bridget.
Happy to be here.
Thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
We'll see you guys next week.